5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Earth below us, drifting, falling, flow.
Welcome to AnnaZone 23, where we look at old anime, especially movies and OVAs. These are the films and projects that help shape the anime landscape as we know it today. We want to look at them in their own era and how they were the inspiration for many of the shows and franchises that are popular today. Some have become legends, while others have been deservedly forgotten. All of them, you should remind yourself, someone had to draw that. Thanks, Major Tom. Hello and welcome back to another episode of AnnaZone 23. I'm Rick.
And I'm Drew.
And this week we are once again going to the works of the legendary Hayao Miyazaki. And well, last time we talked about his breakthrough work of Lupin Castle of Cagliostro. We're going to be talking this week about one of his projects that is really the start of what we call Miyazaki films. What is identifiable as a Miyazaki film. And that is Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind.
Yep. Now, this is, we're actually several years after, well,
three or four.
When we got started, the first thing that Miyazaki did immediately after doing the Lupin stuff was that he did Great Detective Holmes, which is an anthropomorphic steampunk Sherlock Holmes story, which is pretty fun, and it's got some cultural penetration here and there, and he only directed half the episodes. But that paid the bills, and he did a couple more episodes of Lupin for the next series. That's Albatross Wings of Death and Farewell Lovely Lupin, who had a heroine that will look rather familiar when this comes out. But what he wanted to do was an original property of his own. And at that point, nobody really... I mean, he hadn't lost money making the last Lupin movie, but he hadn't made an incredible amount of money either. So nobody really wanted to back him on making his project. So he's asked around and was given a slot in a monthly anime and monthly manga anthology and started a series called Nausicaä in the Valley of the Wind, which is one of the handful of times he's ever done, it's the only time he's ever done extensive manga work. He's done a lot of manga short stories, but this one went 7 volumes in the format that it's been published in. It's very rough. I would say that Miyazaki's manga style is a little bit like Shiro's and a lot like Moebius's. Not as much as Dragon's Heaven, dude, but he's got a lot of Moebius in him. A lot of dust.
And if you're not familiar who Moebius is, that would be Jean Girard. Moebius was his pseudonym as an artist and very unique art style. Lots of very interesting use of watercolor tones. And he likes spindly walker things too.
He was one of the first to use bipedal birds as a common locomotion, although the original user of that is the Chronicles of Gore, the Tarl Kava novels. But nobody likes to bring that up, so we'll give him credit instead.
He also apparently did a lot of Western, like Wild West comic illustrations as well.
Yes, well, there are a lot of Wild West comics in France, so that doesn't surprise me at all. And that was also the peak era of spaghetti Westerns and European Westerns in general. In general, Moebius is very famous for his influence on a lot of other artists. He's not really a heavy metal artist, but he's adjacent to almost everybody who ever ended up drawing for it. And is usually considered an indirect influence on Star Wars. Here's the thing. Lucas probably does not really know that much about Moebius. However, the guys that he hired to do his designs probably were familiar with Moebius.
Like Ralph McQuarrie.
Yeah, Ralph McQuarrie probably had several Moebius books along with several other types of books in his stash.
Especially if you look at a lot of his concept art for the original Star Wars films.
Yeah, that style was very common in the early 70s, but it really has, there's a lot of Moebius in it, especially the Tatooine stuff and everything else. But, again, they have a lot in common. And the manga was successful enough that he was able to get the money together and basically pull together parts and pieces of what was Topcraft. Topcraft were basically known as Rankin Bass's Japanese assistants.
Yeah.
They did a lot of the in-betweens. They probably did quite a bit of the key animation for sure on The Hobbit, on The Return of the King, and later on, and finally, actually, on, because that's about when Rankin Bass died out, on The Last Unicorn.
Yeah, and if you look at some of Rankin Bass's 2D stuff from the era, less so their stuff that's done in their Super Filmation style, the stop motion, but more in like The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, Last Unicorn, those animated works, The Hobbit.
Lord of the Rings is actually
that's Ralph Bakshi. I always forget,
which is in a similar style, but it's a distinctive style.
It's Bakshi style, not.
And Bakshi also borrowed the bipedal bird critters for wizards. So everybody liked their bipedal.
Kind of a case
of
everyone's borrowing from everybody in this case.
Yes, there's an awful lot of stealing going on. We'll get back to some of it. Oh, by the way, we're going to kind of drop off on the who's borrowing from who for a moment, but Miyazaki and Moebius actually have met, corresponded, got along like a house of fire, apparently. Well enough that Mr. Moebius's daughter's name happens to be Nausicaa. So the man with the most French name in the world has a daughter with a very Greek name.
Very Greek name.
If you're wondering about, where have I ever heard of that? It's like, Nausicaa is a very, very minor character in the Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, when Odysseus or Ulysses is discovered at the beginning on Calypso's Island, having washed up after being on Calypso's Island, looking like hell, the princess that finds him is Nausicaa. And that's her entire role in the entire Odyssey. So, very important character, but not here.
Really, this is a fantastic... I will say this about Nausicaa, like, right off the bat. In addition to all this, you know, barring from everything, it is a fascinating film. It's a very fascinating film. Because it's both a Miyazaki film, but it's also a proto-Miyazaki film at the same time.
It has a lot of Miyazaki's fingerprints on it, but it still has a lot of the leftover fingerprints of a lot of the big movies of the 70s.
And since it's being worked with Topcraft.
Its ink and paint composition is very Topcraft.
Yes.
It really, I mean, if you
specifically
put
the backgrounds.
Nausicaa, right? Yes, especially the backgrounds. If you put Nausicaa up with Last Unicorn to some extent, but especially Return of the King, the little Rankin Bass special. Several of Bakshi's things when he wasn't cheaping out and using live action backgrounds, bits of Wizards, and a couple of other movies that got done in the 70s, it really looks, it background wise, like it was like a throwback to the 70s.
If you were to put Nausicaa between a screenshot from Nausicaa, between a screenshot from Last Unicorn and a screenshot from, say, Castle in the Sky, it's going to look closer to Top Unicorn. The characters are going to look like Castle in the Sky, but. Yep. Everything else is going to look...
Castle in the Sky is a couple of years ahead of time. That's the actual true beginning of Ghibli. And Ghibli has their own particular style that is very clean. It's probably even more expensive. Very Disney-esque.
Yes.
This has got a little bit of Rescuers in it. It for being made in the mid-80s, it looks like it was made in the 70s. The backgrounds are very 70s. It's kind of weird because it's almost like it's regressed from Castle Cagliostro, which actually looks more forward than it does.
Yeah, it does. It's kind of, it's
the backgrounds, they really have that grit on them. You have a lot of that Moebius.
No, it's
grit.
Certain parts. There's some parts that look, like I said, certain scenes. Because if you take certain scenes, and we'll start talking more about the actual film itself here in a minute. But there's certain scenes, for something like some of the village scenes, those look straight out of a Miyazaki film. But specifically when you're in the Sea of Corruption. That's
when you're in the Sea of Corruption and some of the longer distance shots and a lot of the manga work, especially.
Yes.
Really much more so. But the interesting thing about Nausicaa and the Valley of the Wind is, well, we have a female protagonist who we are introduced to pretty darned, really darned early in the movie.
So we start off with one of our secondary characters. Well, yeah, I guess you'd call him as he's a major secondary character. And that is,
he's the hero of the last story. It hasn't ever been written.
If there ever was a prequel to Nausicaa, or if for some reason Miyazaki ever made a prequel to Nausicaa, Lord Yupa would be the main character of that story.
And appropriately enough, in the English version, when Disney got it, they got Patrick Stewart.
That is Sir Patrick Stewart to you, sir.
Only in England, sir. Only in England. Anyhow, yes, he's very, and that should tell you Acres right there. This is the man who was, you know, this is somebody who was once the hero, but this is like the next generation.
Yeah,
he's doing the Obi-Wan bit.
In the very beginning of the movie, he's actually looking at so the basic premise, and we'll go over premise and we'll go over plot as we go, and we'll go over characters as we go. The basic plot of Nausicaa, the Valley of the Wind, is that it's 1,000 years after an apocalypse known as the 7 Days of Fire, basically just destroyed the whole planet. And since then, there's this, some call it the Sea of Corruption, some call it a toxic jungle, depending on which translation you're looking at. It's basically a poisonous forest swarming with giant insects
and fungus.
This is kind of interesting because so this film has a prologue to it. We don't start immediately in Act One. We start in a prologue. It's a fairly lengthy prologue too, because what happens in the prologue is we get introduced to Lord Yupa. He's researching this toxic jungle, which has overtaken another village or another kingdom, is what he said specifically. This jungle, which is toxic to humans, you have to wear a face mask. Oh, really relevant that we're carrying or that we're covering this now. but
this is like a respirator face mask. We're talking Dominion level face mask.
Closer to just gas mask, to be honest.
Yeah, pretty much a respirator gas mask type thing.
You know, he's seeing that. And then we cut to the first of our main characters. She's exploring the jungle. So one of the big creatures in this is what's called an Om or an Omu, which is like a big trilobite thing.
Pillbug. Right. But 30 foot tall, 50 foot tall, really
like,
big.
Like size of a Zeppelin, but on the ground. Oh, and by the way, there's thousands of them around the world.
Maybe not quite as long as a Zeppelin, but pretty damn big.
A blimp then, a modern blimp.
You remember those pillbox tank things they had in StarCraft that Proteus had? Guess where they stole them from?
Probably. More than likely. So,
wouldn't surprise me. So she's found one of their old skins because they're insects. They shed their skin, just like a cicada. And so there's a 50-foot empty shell that's translucent in spots and transparent over where the eyes were. And so she's working her way. Well, first she's taking fungus samples and putting them in test tubes. In a scene, while looking through goggles, in a scene that is pretty familiar to anybody who's watched a certain J.J. Abrams remake movie. And it gets even more so when she rappels herself down off of the Omu later.
Yeah.
And even more so when she walks out of the forest with her gun over her shoulder Let's just say, Rey from Star Wars Episode 7 owes a whole lot to Nausicaa.
And one of the things is, it's in order to what we kind of, she's both exploring the jungle. As we find out later, she is actually looking into the science of the jungle and going a little bit beyond. A lot of people look at the jungle and only look at it from like a literal surface level perspective. And we'll talk about this more when we talk about the main themes of the film. But she's looking past the surface of things, and she sees, even though there's just this monstrous poisonous jungle, she can see the beauty in it, you know, despite it being this dangerous place for, you know, human beings. And that's one of the things that we learned very early on about Nausicaa, is that's part, major part of her, you know, of her, character arc. And, but it's
friend to all living,
she's friend to all living things. But since this is, you know, it's a shell, she actually uses gunpowder from her rifle to blow one of the eyepieces off, one of the lenses.
Well, to crack it up that she can cut it.
Yeah,
which
she can pry it up.
Yeah, she can chop, basically go around and just use it as a puncher almost to get it out. But it gives her a starter
position. And, you know, so we've now established, and then, you know, she leaves and she hears commotion. And that's when Lord Yupa and Nausicaa meet up after she saves Yupa from an ohm that was rampaging. She actually saves him not by killing it, but by calming it. This is very important. At which point, both of them go back to her village, which is in the Valley of the Wind. And that's where we get the second part of our title.
Yeah. It is and we say kingdom, we're talking maybe 1,000 people. It's a very small country, and small country kind of wedged in between the mountains and the sea.
It's like a Liechtenstein.
Valley of the Wind. It's very Ghibli Hills. It's too not flat to be the Netherlands, but it's got windmills.
It's like Liechtenstein with windmills.
But on the ocean.
Yeah, near the ocean.
Yeah, Liechtenstein is nowhere near
the ocean. No, it's in the middle of the mountains.
So she comes back, and the first night back, there is an appearance by a gigantic flying machine. It's a plane. It looks
a lot like, and this is basically where the first act kicks off. It's like, think like the giant military cargo aircraft, but like 10, 15 times the size of the big, you know, military airlifters that you might have seen before in films or even flying around your hometown, you know, depending on where you live.
It looks like if you took one of the really big planes of the 20s and 30s, the ones that were big enough that had room in the wings for tunnels for the,
from like a design standpoint,
and just scaled it up to gargantuan size, like bigger than a C5.
Yeah, we're way bigger than a C5. Like think more along the lines of it's
the Dorinir 10 or the Spruce Goose.
Yeah, and even those would be dwarfed by some of these things. Like ludicrously large aircraft, like impractically large aircraft. Well, it goes down.
it's been swarmed by insects. The crew is blinded or dead or both, and it crashes short of the farmland of the valley, at the edge of the farmland of the Valley of the Wind.
Yeah, it's on like the very edge of their
The people go out to try to rescue survivors, of which there are none, and then to check the cargo and put out the fire. Nausicaa finds the only intact person, who is a young woman who has chains on her hands, which is not a good sign, and a bad wound in her chest, and does not live very long before expiring.
No.
Where people find a mass of flesh of some unknown description.
Just a big, large, pulsating ball.
Yeah. So, and this is noted as coming from one country, but the girl came from another country.
Yes. Both of these countries are implied to be not very nice.
Not very nice, and at war with each other. And
they brought their war onto the Valley's just, doorstep.
Yeah, now just people are kind of playing Belgium.
Yeah,
they are the road. They're the proxy. Plus, they're holding on to the MacGuffin that they both want. And so the next day, Nauschka's out for a bit checking some things. And when she, by the time she gets back, the people from the...
The people who own the plane that crashed.
The people that own the plane that crashed have shown up, led by Princess Kushana, who's a major player, and her assistant.
Yes.
Kushana
and her assistant, Kurotowa. They both show up.
They both
show up. How's best to describe these two? Kushana is. I honestly think Kushana is a fascinating character.
A regal woman in armor who takes charge, is quite polite but quite forceful, is also clearly on a mission that she does not necessarily approve of, but this is what she does. I've commented before, she's essentially. We later find out, especially in the manga, where we get a lot more about her backstory, she's essentially Zuko.
Say that.
She has been set out to do the dirty work of her families because her brothers think that Game of Thrones is a bit of light entertainment.
I'd say that's a pretty accurate description. She's not a villain. She is the antagonist. But she is, and it's a case of she believes that she's doing what she's doing, that it's for the survival of humanity. Which, yeah, many villains have said that. But unlike many other villains, she isn't delusional enough that when she is proven wrong, to deny it.
No. And the other thing that comes across, it's much better spelled out in the manga, but the relationship between her and Kurotowa, because Kurotowa is sort of a lackey.
He's a
character.
Weasel.
He's a bit of a weasel. Oh, by the way, if she's Zuko, then that would make Lord Yupa is essentially Uncle Iroh. That's the other character I thought that Yupa definitely inspired to some.
Yeah, it's like, what if Yupa? What if Yupa was in Kushana's life as opposed to Nausicaa's life?
Yeah. But the big thing about those two is that you can kind of tell, you know, he acts like a lackey and everything else. And when Kushana goes missing at a later point, he's like, okay,
my turn.
No, it's not my turn. It's okay. I guess we're mercenaries now. Like, I'm going to just hijack her entire force. And we find out more or less the reason in the manga, because we get the scene where he's first assigned to her. And he, you know, does the whole, it's an honor to work with you. And she's like, don't make me laugh. I'm sure several of my brothers have offered you huge amounts of money to see that I die in some unfortunate accident. And he looks at her and says, well, yes, but I know that you know that they said that, and you also know that the odds of me surviving long enough to collect any reward they've offered, if I do succeed in killing you, is exceedingly remote. So let's just try to get along.
He's
so they have
his own survival.
He's slimy, but he's openly
his own
slimy.
Survival is he wears it on his sleeve that's what he cares the most about.
Yeah. He's essentially Claude Rains' character from Casablanca.
Yeah.
He's crooked as hell, but he's very open about it. He's just like, yeah, your brother's offered me wondrous rewards to see you get killed. And if I actually succeeded, I'm sure they'd kill me first next. So let's just ignore that. So they're an interesting pseudo couple almost, although there's no real romantic tension between them at all.
No, there's not. It's
but as a superior servant tension, it's kind of interesting because he's so slimy and she knows it and he knows that she knows it. And
it's an open
so
secret.
They get along pretty well. Yeah. They're just like, it's an interesting dynamic. But when Nauschka gets back, she finds that Kushana's men have already moved up into the castle and have gotten into her father's bedchamber. He's been bedridden. He's been dying already, and they've just hastened him along into the path of actually being dead. And this is where we discover something about Nauska. Nauska may be friend to all living things. Nauska may let a little weasel creature drink her blood to let it trust her. But Nauska doesn't even get into, doesn't even bother to spout the "my name is" or "you killed my father."
She goes straight to the murking dudes.
She takes out her weapon and starts killing fools. She has three guys down before Lord Yupa can show up and get in the way and stop it's this before it turns into
a massacre.
A really bad massacre.
Well, yeah, it's the way that I describe Nauska's character. She's a pacifist, but she's an environmental pacifist as opposed. So it's
she
like,
does have
yeah,
temper.
It's like she could easily become an eco-terrorist.
Yeah, she could be a lot of.
She'd
things.
Be a very good
and the
eco-terrorist.
Other thing is, though, Lord Yupa is good at pointing out. Basically, he's pointing out to her. It's like, look, your father is dead. He was going to die anyway. You are now in charge. You do not have the time or the opportunity to take petty vengeance.
Yeah, you need to.
So negotiate.
You need to lead.
Yeah, you need to lead. You need to do what is best for the Valley.
Yes.
Because you are in command now. Congratulations.
It is an interesting scene because it's like if you look at the weapon she uses, like that does not look very dangerous. And yet she takes down four fucking dudes.
Yeah. Like I said, and she goes from zero to holy cow, she just wasted three dudes so fast you don't even get really a chance to blink.
Yeah, it happens very quickly.
It moves on from there that Kushana explains that the mass of flesh that was on the previous ship is the remains of what's called a god warrior, which is one of the giant creatures that basically set off the 7 days.
Yeah,
of fire.
I think they just call it giant warrior in the movie. They never really called the god.
It's god warrior. Yeah. It's had several names. And it looks a little bit familiar because a certain up and coming animator got hired on at this point and got along really well with Miyazaki. Miyazaki basically said, okay, this giant world wrecking creature, he's your baby. You do the scenes. And that particular gentleman was Hideaki Anno.
Yes.
This was one of his very first professional bits, and certainly his first professional bit as a primary key animator, as like having actual scenes assigned to him, you know, by as part of a production posse on a movie. If it looks a bit like an Ava,
it's probably
on. There's a reason.
But we haven't got to that part yet.
Yeah, but when the creature starts appearing and you're saying, you know, that looks a bit like an angel or an Evangelion, it's like, well.
There's another thing that we learn as well during this whole mess, and that's that Nauska has actually created her own research lab way down below her house.
Way down in the basement of the castle. And she is determining.
And the main thing she determines is that it's not the jungle plants itself that are toxic. It's that the water is polluted, like all around the world. And so wherever this giant forest is growing, because the way it spreads is that when the insects rampage and leave the forest and then they die because, you know, they have nowhere that they can, you know, sustain themselves. They have no source of food. So they die out there. They carry the spores from the forest out with them, and that's what caused the forest to spread. But all of the ground is polluted. But way under the ground, it's not polluted. The water's pure, and then the plants do not create any kind of toxins.
The plants are a filter. It's just, as a side effect, they are purifying the water. But because they're in the most poisonous areas, it's also not really fit for human habitation. So it might be possible that eventually things will get better, but it might get worse, and it might be evolving to a level that humans aren't going to be able to deal
with. And so all of this happens, and
then Kushana decides to take Nauska and a few of her
old guys,
couple of her random old guys, and
Yupa's not one of them.
They get loaded on the plane and sent out, and they are going back to her place at this point.
Going back to the
Kushana is a Tolmekian princess, and they're going back to the Tolmekian capital.
So she can basically take her oath of allegiance, be introduced around, yada yada yada. Kushana's giving her all the proper politeness, but she did just basically hijack her kingdom.
You can almost look at it as the English to the Powhatan natives. And yeah, Nausicaa is Pocahontas.
Yeah, she's definitely getting, they're definitely, she's not getting a whole lot of choice in this. I'm trying to remember one of the scenes. Is it the scene with Yupo and in the beginning with the village that's been burned out, or is it a later burned out village? There is a particular scene where what's left of one of the villages is shown, and we don't see any bodies, but we see a little doll in the debris.
I believe that is that's the opening. And there's dolls, but there's also skeletons.
Yeah. But okay, there are skeletons. But do you remember where the doll scene was borrowed from? For?
I do not, off the top of my head.
Mulan.
Oh, that's Disney right. Mulan. There's going to be a lot of Disney
folks. A lot of people stole from this movie in big chunks. Some of them who even worked on the movie came back and stole some chunks.
Some of the people that stole from the movie later got involved with the movie. But we'll get to that during distribution.
There's a lot of stories on this. But the big thing is Kushana's taking Nausicaa back to, the Central Kingdom. And they're flying along in formation, and then suddenly an attack plane comes in and starts shooting everything up really badly.
Yeah, it's a Pajetian. So that girl that died earlier was the princess of a country called Pajet or Pajit, P-E-J-I-T-E, and this is a Pajetan fighter. And it shoots down every single
by her brother.
By her brother. What I find funny is that they have escort aircraft. The escort is nowhere to be found until after he has shot down every single transport aircraft.
He knows what he's doing. Came out of the sun or hid in the clouds.
Yeah, but the fighter should have shown up. By the first time that he came by.
Well, the upshot is. Nausicaa manages to get into the tow plane for the glider. Her other people are in the glider, and they've attached. And she gets into the tow plane with her right-hand man from the village. And
because,
Kushana.
Like I said, they shot down all the transport aircraft, so that means that, they're flying in her village's gunship, because they took that. By the way, they have a gunship for some reason. That's never really explained why the Valley of the Wind has a singular gunship.
Because you need something to keep the flyers off.
That's something I can think of.
Yeah, if you're going to have one thing, it was left by Chad. Chad left it, that's it. Or, who is it? Who's the guy from, who's the guy who left the ship behind in Battle Beyond the Stars? That's the same, trope. Anyhow, the upshot is that eventually the tow plane and the glider, having rendezvoused in the Sea of Corruption forest, fly off. Nausicaa takes her personal glider and locates our hero, the pilot. Well, our male protagonist, I guess you could say. He has a very small role. Even in the manga, he's not a major character.
Yeah, the most important thing about Azbel is that he is connected with Lestelle, who's the princess of Pajit, by being her brother, which is important for later, because...
But mostly he's there to get back with the other team as right.
Yeah, because where they crash land in the jungle. Or not, well, the glider crash lands in the jungle.
The glider crash lands in the jungle, the gunship lands near it, hooks up and drags it away, but...
But then we find the secret of the jungle during this section, and that is the crystalline jungle, which it turns out, so like we said earlier, the jungle's a filter. It's actually purifying the soil and water deep within like the recesses of the jungle where like humans can't really get to because it's so deep into the forest, because either the people that go in there either die of insect attack, or they
or
the spores get to them.
And in fact, Nausicaa and our friend nearly get eaten by a very large centipede, flying yes. centipede on their way down. So this is not too surprising. So they are on their way back to the Valley of the Wind, but they get there second because in the meantime,
they get captured first.
Yeah, they get captured. Well, they get grabbed.
They get
picked up by
Asbel's people.
Asbel's people, which means that now Nausicaa has been captured by both evil empires. Meantime, Kushana gets herself back to the Valley.
Yeah,
of the
she
Wind.
Manages to get back.
At which point, she discovers that the Valley of the Wind people are not as harmless as she thought, as they have basically stolen one of her tanks, destroyed the bridge in a manner that will be stolen by girls in Panzer 25 years, 30 years on, almost 40 years.
Yes. On. What I find is, so there is one line I really love from the English dub from this whole sequence when Kushana shows up, and it's, we were talking earlier about Kurotawa's his personality. When she suddenly shows up, he's just sort of like, oh well.
Yeah, guess I'm not going to be a mercenary, not going to be a wandering mercenary.
He's like, this is fine.
Yeah, well, this is probably safer. Yeah. Whatever. But the people of the Valley of the Wind have moved to the wreckage of an old submarine that's beached at the edge of the ocean and are
taking shelter in there,
basically holding out and making ugly faces at Kushana's people.
And they're basically being led by, at this point, since Nausicaa's not there, they're being led by Yupa and then Obaba, I believe it is. Yeah, it's Obaba because it's Tress McNeil, who's the...
It's Obaba because Obaba just means old woman.
And she, well, like many old women in Miyazaki stories, she earlier on, tells of a prophecy.
We have to borrow from early
OSP.
We have to do the same thing we did. Yes, Overly Sarcastic Productions. There is
a prophecy.
Prophecy.
Cue guitar. Guitar.
That a girl, that a figure clad in blue,
which is interesting because we know Nausicaa wears blue, right? But by this point, she has changed clothes. She is now wearing pink because when they got picked up by the Bajitans to have her escape, the mother, Asbel and Lestel, basically has her switch places with, I'm guessing, maybe a maid or something like one of her
random girl
that's approximately the same size as Nausicaa, so that she can escape again in the gunship.
Meanwhile, Lord Yuba goes into full boarding action mode to distract.
They go into full rebellion mode, basically. They've stolen a tank.
Well, he's basically saying, yeah, Fujiko, you're a wuss. Watch this. I'm going to take this whole thing.
And so while that's going on back at the valley, Nausicaa escapes. And we discover what the Pajitan's plan was. Right before Nausicaa escapes, is that they're going to enrage Ohm and lure them to the Valley of the Wind to destroy it because they do not want the Temekians using the God Warrior.
Yes, that's a pretty much three-sided Mexican.
And as they're making it back
to the
Valley of the Wind, Nausicaa finds out how they're bringing the Ohm to the valley. They run across a small airship.
Yeah.
It looks like Bowser Jr.'s little thing he flies around in the Mario series. It's like a cauldron with a propeller on the bottom of it.
It looks like the bit of Maria the Virgin Witch. I think they had something kind of like just cauldron, which wouldn't surprise me any, because again, everybody stole from this.
But what's important is what's attached to the bottom of the airship, which is a baby Ohm. Yeah, it's the size of a bug. And the poor thing is it's bleeding. It's been brutal. It's really, it's honestly, it's kind of,
it's been brutal.
I mean, I know it's like, for a lot of people, it's like, but it's a bug. I'm like, still kind of unsettling. And it is, you know, it was crying.
It's wriggling and it was carefully animated. And yeah, it's making awful noises. And at this point, Naushka, remember, Naushka has this own private glider of hers, which she's been using to get around on whenever she's not in the gunship, which is a really cool sort of jet-propelled glider thing she rides over the top of. And she comes in standing up on it, standing in the saddle, so to speak.
Right at two armed men.
And she jumps off.
Right, well,
one old man and one little kid. The guy, two armed men. Yeah, one of whom is probably 40, and of course, and one of whom is maybe 16.
What I love about it is she T poses for dominance.
She comes in, arms spread, you know, jumps off the back of it and just comes and kind of glides in like that and gets shot in the ankle for her trouble. She takes a couple machine gun bullets through her ankle, and then then crashes the gondola, which means that she's sitting on the edge of the acid sea with acid eating into her wound, trying to talk.
The baby almost trying to get to
and trying to help,
which is
the
on
baby
the other side of the acid lake, rampaging. It's trying to go path of least resistance, mm-hmm. which is through the acid lake. And apparently, normally Ohm can handle the acid water or the acid no problem, but this one's severely wounded. Yes.
Yes. And so is Naushka, for that matter. There is a commentary track with Ono and one of the other directors, and they were making comments about who did the shots with Naushka with her ankle dipping into the water, the acid water. He's like, oh, that had to be Miyazaki. Miyazaki would do that to a character. They're not quite making a joke out of it, but they're just like, yeah, that's the kind of thing.
And it's interesting because, you know, she does prevent it from going further, you know, into the acid water. And then the guys are just like, oh, well. And then again, showing her not giving a damn about people that piss her off. She grabs the machine gun they had mounted on their little flying or airship and just threatens them to take her back or take her and the Ohm to the horde or the herd.
The herd. Yes. And by this point,
blue.
She's covered in
so
Ohm
now her
blood,
outfit is completely blue.
Blue.
Guitar solo.
Just like the prophecy.
That's what I'm just saying.
Guitar
solo.
Sorry. But so she's trying to get out in front of this Ohm stampede. Kushana's trying to warm up the guns to stop the Ohm stampede with the God Soldier. And she tries.
It gets one shot off, and then it
does
melts.
Make a mess of things before it melts. Gets one and it melts. I mean, and it melts.
Yeah, you can see. You can definitely see where some of the ideas from End of Eva, there's some certain shots first made their appearance here.
And there are bits when Rey is also
there's that too.
The angel right before she explodes. Yeah, there's a lot of there
that
just
come
so
back
many
in later works
in this movie that people. Yeah, so now she gets out in front of the Ohm, and
yeah, she gets trampled.
Basically, gets run over. But she's trampled. But she's she's trampled into the air because they end up kind of picking her up with their flagella. There's this golden flagella. It looks like
well,
a
first,
sea of
first,
wheat
well,
almost,
the thing is, she gets trampled and she's dead. She's on the ground, and that's when the Ohm stop their rampage.
Yeah, and then she's borne above by these golden flagella, and she was only mostly dead because she's no longer all the way dead. Now she's gone from, you know, friend of all living things to Nigh Messiah.
Of all living things.
Yeah. You know, she has fulfilled the prophecy in a big way. And this essentially shuts down the three-way war because everybody's kind of like, well, I can't top that.
Yeah, boy, got nothing.
And yeah, I got nothing. And we have Kushana heading back to her kingdom, and the other, everybody's basically heading back to where they began. But things, you know, there's some sense that things are changing. That the
things
world,
things aren't changed, but they're going to.
Yes. There may become a day when the world will change so much that men will no longer be able to live on it. Or that it will change enough that men will be able to live on all of it again.
It's a story. It's left kind of vague. It's interesting. And this is kind of where we can start talking about the theme of the movie. It's vague. It's a definite anti-war, pro-Earth method or message, or environment, pro-environmental message. It's so much to the point.
The manga version is way much more complicated.
So much to the point that the WWF, that's the Worldwide Fund for Nature, not Vince McMahon's House of Tussle.
Worldwide Life Fund, the one with the panda.
Yeah, not the WrestleMania one. They actually recommended it. You fire up the film, it still has the Worldwide Fund for Nature logo in the opening credits. And no doubt. It's a very interesting film because the primary theme that I took from it is that sometimes the Earth does things that are destructive, but that's the Earth's way of trying to heal itself from what humans have done to it. Because there's no bones about it. The Earth is messed up the way it is because of the 7 days of fire, because of the war of humans 1,000 years ago.
Yeah. It has the Miyazaki nature view on it, which is kind of a Lovecraftian environmentalism.
Yeah, you are small
and part of the problem, and the world is big and doesn't really give a crap about.
Yeah, it is a little Lovecraftian. It's a little bit of existential horror in that regard, but it's a very important one to think about.
Yeah, and which gives it a certain amount of balance. And again, the manga ends a little bit differently. The manga, again, ends with the wars finally ending, but by that point, Kushana has essentially become a Denethor for her country. She will not take the throne, but she is essentially the ward of the throne.
She's like the chancellor.
All of her brothers are regent, dead. So is her
she's
dad.
Regent without being queen.
Yeah, she's permanent regent. And by that point, now she's like her inspiration, but also the queen of a much smaller part of the kingdom. Because, you know, Nausicaa has her valley. But it's very much of the Nausicaa is the holy one, the inspiration for everything. And that's how the story runs. The manga also has a few other details that didn't make it into the anime, which inform certain other shows. We know that Kushana's brothers have been plotting to kill her whenever possible for the last whoever knows how long. We also know that they made an attempt to poison her and managed to poison her mother so much that her mother lost her mind, which sounds like a very familiar story. In fact, it was, in fact, she doesn't recognize Kushan anymore, just a doll. Which is a very familiar story because it was later used by the guy in Familiar of Zero. Ha ha ha. Well, he kind of borrowed it back. He did it with his Ray clone.
Yeah.
We know where Anno used it himself. Yes. The other piece of extra story like that, and there are a lot of extra stories in there, but that was one of them. We have a bit in the movie, Kushana is explicitly said to be missing a couple of limbs. We see her literally wind the gauntlet off of her armor, and there's nothing there.
It's explained. And she
makes a remark to the effect of she's missing quite a bit of her body.
She's basically a torso, a head, and an arm. Pretty much.
It's implied. Yeah. We never see the actual damage.
But it's pretty heavily implied, to be honest.
In the manga, she doesn't have that, but she does have a number of other issues. And we also see her cut off her ponytail, or her braid. It's actually not a ponytail. It's a full braid down to her butt, and leave it for some of her soldiers who are killed in yet another last stand, of which there have been
many,
several. Yeah, it's very much shown that her men are of incredible loyalty to her. Which is probably the only reason she's still alive. Is she inspires such loyalty. Because there's obviously a long list of people who want her dead. What was the other bits for that? But
Interesting to really talk about, because the manga's got a lot. Unfortunately, I haven't read it. So there's less for me to be able to comment on that. But what I am able to comment on is this movie's got a very interesting release history when it comes to localization.
There is that. Well, I'd like to talk about the basic release history first. Because this came out after Macross, Do You Remember Love? But this was like the two punch to Macross's one punch. Macross made it really big, but it was very fan-oriented. Mm-hmm. It really is very much a genre picture. There are plenty of Japanese people who don't know Macross, but there are plenty that do. But everybody knew Naosha.
It's almost more accessible simply because it is an original feature. It's not based on a pre-existing franchise.
It's an original feature, and it's aimed, you know, theme-wise, it's aimed to have much more strict themes. And a lot of very serious movie critics in Japan kind of glomped onto it, because Japanese live action movies had gotten pretty horrible by then. Toei and Toho were not turning out their finest product.
If I remember correctly, some of the most popular things of the era was the Godzilla movies and then like delinquent schoolgirl movies. Were pretty popular.
There's a lot of Skabon movies. There was the Godzilla 1985 or 1984 Return of Godzilla.
The second series of Godzilla. Basically. Because that also had Godzilla versus Destroya.
That was a little...
It was part of the same series. Well, technically now four eras of Godzilla movies.
But the point was, there was just so much there, and there wasn't a whole lot of good, you know, make jokes about Hollywood doing inappropriate drama stuff. But Japan wasn't turning out anything like that that was any good. You know, we have to also point out that the nature god in the room, or the big wolf in the room, Princess Mononoke, which is another Ghibli film,
kind of this again,
is basically Naushka 2 historical Boogaloo.
It's set it, more in it, history.
If we're going to tease Abrams for borrowing the first 10 minutes of Naushka for Force Awakens,
we have to tease Miyazaki, or the great Miyazaki, about borrowing his own movie,
about redoing his own movie. Although I will say this. Princess Mononoke is done more from the prince's view.
It's almost Miyazaki, or not Miyazaki, Nausicaa, but the point of view is flipped.
Yes.
Because you really don't spend a ton of time with Mononoke.
Nope. With San? No.
You don't spend a lot of time with San.
San is very, and she doesn't have a whole lot of words, but Lady Eboshi is essentially Kushana.
Yes, she is.
I mean, and there's an equivalent to Kurotoa, but he's not working so directly for Eboshi in that one. It's a little more complicated. But yeah, he does. If you ever. And that one looks like a Ghibli movie. So that would be the other interesting thing, because everybody, as I said, we've pointed out whole scenes that have been taken from it. I left out the guy who did the Gamera movies, the Heisei Gameras.
Yeah.
Mentions that he specifically stole a shot from Nausicaa. It was the when there's a shot where Gamera and or the monster he's chasing breaks through the clouds, rising up through them. That's essentially, he says, yeah, I stole that shot straight from Nausicaa. You know, he's like, "Mei Koopla, I just went in, I took that scene, I stole it. That's all I have to say." And, you know, as we said, Anno borrowed chunks and bits. He wanted to do a Kushana miniseries of his own at some point, but Miyazaki wouldn't let him. There was, and we've seen lots of other movies borrow scenes from it, up to including Girls and Panzer, for gosh sakes. It's a very borrowed from movie. It's a very good movie, which is why it was. When people steal, they usually steal from good movies. This is a very good movie. This is Miyazaki saying, this is what is important to me.
Yes.
Because the Lupin movie, the problem is he's like taking other people's characters and kind of twisting them to fit his vision.
Yeah, because like we discussed in our Tagliostro,
it's not quite a Lupin show. It works a little bit as a Lupin show, but it's not a perfect fit. This is a much better fit because he wrote characters, he can give them three-dimensionality. He can build nuance into them. And he does. All the characters have a certain amount of nuance to them. The villains aren't entirely villainous. The heroine does have a nasty temper. I mean, granted, she had perfectly good reason to, but she does kill three fools in 10 seconds and right in the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
But the other thing, though, is as important as this was in Japan, this is actually one of the harder anime movies to get a hold of intact or to see intact for a long, long time.
Yeah, because you had you only had one release of it for a long time, and it was it wasn't good.
Yeah, this is interesting because this was localized to the U.S. within a few years.
Not even within a few years, within a year.
Yeah,
it released theatrically in 1985, and that film was.
Which is a cut down cut, and the actual plot isn't as butchered as you think it is from the cover. From the cover, you're like, are you doing Star Wars? Are you doing Dune? And where the heck is the main character? Because you've got some guy riding this Ohm thing like it's a sandworm.
It's using what looks like one of the covers looks like it's using the He-Man and the Masters of the Universe font.
Yeah, the cover is part of the biggest problem. The fact that they cut 30 minutes out of the movie doesn't help. Granted, there's enough padding in the movie that you could get away with it to some degree.
It looks like there was an alternate cover. Which actually is so you have the green text, which has them writing the God Warrior, a bunch of guys writing the God Warrior, and Nausicaa is like thrown up in the corner of the picture.
Yep.
There's another one which actually has a very westernized version of Nausicaa on her glider front and center. But I'm guessing that was probably a reprint.
That is, and considering that it has, I see it, and considering that it has a U on it, that's quite possibly a later British release, because U rating is not a American rating.
So the Brits didn't get screwed on it, just the US did.
No, they probably got the same 30 minutes cut out of it.
Oh, I'm sure they did. It's just they didn't have a stupid cover.
Yeah, they didn't have the cover that's like, wait a minute, where's the Pegasus from? Who are, what? Yeah, the cover is, I mean, the cover of Warriors of the Wind for Britain is weird, but it's weird in an interesting way, and it does look very 70s.
It's very, very 70s or 80s, like, novel. It looks like it belongs on a novel.
Yeah.
Like the old release of like The Giver or Ender's Game or one of those.
Little fuzzy.
Like the ones I would have had in the 90s when I was a kid.
Something like that. That is
weird, right?
There's that cut, which was, again, has a contemptible cover and a pretty chopped up version of the original plot. And a bad dub at that. But the problem was there wasn't that many good Japanese releases to crib from.
No.
Because, again, this was a very, it's a side project by, you know, a bunch of side things. It is not a Ghibli picture. So it's not directly and completely owned by Studio Ghibli. Now, so we really didn't get a good look at a complete version of it.
Well, until Disney
came back and bought the rights to distribute all of the Ghibli movies.
And that was due to Pixar, really. John Lasseter.
Yeah, John Lasseter was the big push in that. I mean, Disney deciding to grab Miyazaki movies was not a big stretch.
That made sense. I mean, the man's often called the Walt Disney of Japan.
Yeah.
Whether or not that comparison is accurate or not, there's a discussion for another time, but a lot of American fans.
It's close enough in the fact that he, you know, actually got a studio going.
Yes.
A going concern and a permanent concern more than anything else.
I would not
compare him to some of the other creators. Because Disney, while a driver, was not really a creator.
No, he was more of a man. He was more of coordinator. Yeah. I mean, he was an animator. He did his own. He did animation. He did voice acting. He did writing. But by the time his company got big, he was really doing more of really directing.
Yeah, he was directing, influencing, getting things set up.
He let his artists do the hard work. What's interesting about the Disney release, actually, I want to mention this real quick before moving on to our next little bit of discussion, is the voice casting. One of the things that's always interesting about the Ghibli films, because they're licensed by Disney falls back on either people they have in contract, celebrities, or Western voice acting, big names, because we're more familiar with things from that era being voice acted. Things of a similar era are going to have voice actors, such as Stephen J. Bloom, or you might have, Spike Spencer or Tiffany Grant. You know, those are kind of the voice actors we're used to hearing on dubs from things of this era. Disney has voice actors such as, they did have voice actors, but it's voice actors like Jodie Benson, Mark Hamill, Frank Welker, Tress McNeil.
Frank Welker, you got to take a shot.
Yeah. but then they also have big names like a young Shia LaBeouf, which this has been written during his Even Stevens days. Uma Thurman's in this, Edward James Olmos, Chris Sarandon, Patrick Stewart, we mentioned earlier. You know, there's
a lot of the central bits, they like hire people who have a lot of voice acting experience. They don't seem to stunt cast too much, but except for the supporting cast.
But then they hire ones that were more hearing on, you know, shows like The Simpsons or Futurama or, you know, the Western animation.
You'll get some interesting things. Like, you get Patrick Stewart doing Mako, basically.
Yeah.
Doing the Mako role.
But what's interesting to me about this...
Mark Hamill does everything.
Yeah.
He's even like every other Disney movie, it seems like.
Is what happened to Topcraft after... Nausicaa, because by 1985 it's dead, and yet it's not. So what's important to know about Topcraft is that not too long after Nausicaa came out, they got into financial trouble, lots of financial trouble, and in fact there was they did two TV series after two TV series afterwards. One was called Adventures of Little Koala, which apparently ran on Nickelodeon in the States for a while. And what's real interesting is it also did a series called Button Nose, which was the first TV series by Sanrio, the Hello Kitty people. So you would expect that someone's got, like, you know, they had, you know, this in their pocket. They had the Rankin Bass stuff. You think that they'd be doing okay. Well, they went bankrupt.
Well, Rankin Bass was kind of dying in the mid-80s. Last Unicorn was almost their death rattle in a lot of ways.
But they still got, you know, Topcraft got plenty of, you know, had plenty of work. And, you know, those things weren't, they didn't do terribly. At least the other, some of the other ones they worked on. But what's interesting to me is what happened to Topcraft. Because Topcraft didn't stop being involved related to this film after it died. So basically Topcraft, what was left of Topcraft, split into two companies. The first was all of the assets, like the actual, like the building and the equipment, all that went to Toshio Suzuki, Isao Takahata, and of course Hayao Miyazaki, and became Studio Ghibli. The animators from Topcraft went to form another studio called Pacific Animation Corporation. Pacific Animation Corporation continued working with Rankin Bass on some shows you may have heard of, like Silverhawks and Thundercats. But then eventually that died, and then that became Walt Disney Animation Japan. So when this film got, in a roundabout way, when this film got localized by Disney, the two parts of Topcraft were once again working together on the same film.
Yeah, but I doubt there were two people in common left.
Oh, I can guarantee there was none. But it's just
been a few people left in Ghibli that had been in Topcraft when that had been
running. You could kind of do a 5 degrees of Kevin Bacon with that, I guess, at that point.
Yeah. Because, I mean,
connect Topcraft back to each other. Well, Silverhawks, if I remember correctly, was sort of the
late 80s. It was a real short thing. Silverhawks and...
It was an attempt to make another Thundercats.
Silverhawks and Thundercats are both very famous for having really great credits and terrible animation of their actual series.
Yeah, because the credits are like, wow, this is amazing. And then it's, oh, this is sad. But that's neither here nor there of our discussion. I don't really have much more to say on Nausicaa. I would say it's easy to get a hold of.
It's now easy to get a hold of.
It went from being impossible to being pretty simple. I can almost guarantee you, if you go to your local library, you can probably check it out there. Most libraries have, well, all of the Ghibli films, or at least a good majority of them.
Yep, and it's the rough one, though.
It's by no means bad.
It's still a really good film, but you can see some... If you did a marathon of Ghibli movies and you said, this is proto-Ghibli, this is before they were Ghibli.
I'd say proto-Ghibli is a good way to... It's still really good, but it lacks some of the polish that you get with some of the later works.
Yeah, it's really... And again, it really looks like a 70s movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It really carries forward even to a greater extent, like I said, than the Lupin movie, it really carries that mid-70s aesthetic that, you know, just never quite, never, that kind of, in general, died out, thank God. But this is like the good thing that came out of the 70s aesthetic. This is like one of the handful of animated movies that have that 70s aesthetic and actually look pretty good and actually are comprehensible, because there are a number of pretty good looking ones, but you can't make heads or tails of them.
Yep. I can say that certainly about many 70s movies.
Oh,
not even just animated ones.
Yeah, well, not just.
I don't have anything else, Drew. What about you? Do you have anything that, any final thoughts on Nausicaä?
Nausicaä is, again, it's important for what came after it, but it's also kind of almost, it's one of the more purely distilled Miyazaki movies. Again, he essentially remade it with a slightly different point of view 20 years later.
But also, this, the themes are still intact.
This is the first time we see a Miyazaki creation in its full form.
It may not be a Ghibli movie, but it is a Miyazaki movie.
And it's a Miyazaki creation. It's almost, it's entirely original.
Yes.
There are bits and pieces you can see from several other movies, but it's nothing, but it's been stolen from a whole lot more than it ever stole from anything else. There's no two ways about it. And it's just really neat and really nice. And you find little bits to like all through it. And it's one of the handful of movies that doesn't really have a true villain in it.
Even it really doesn't.
Kushana's way too sympathetic to be an actual villain.
Like I said, she's an antagonist, not a villain.
Yeah, she's the antagonist. She's the driving force, but she's not the villain. She kind of acts like it too, because there's a bit where the whole ship is going down in flames, and she's just sitting there like, okay, Nausicaä, you're running to the ship. Are you going to take me? Or are you going to leave me? And it looks, she kind of has the look like she doesn't much care either way, but she's also kind of interested to see how Nausicaä reacts. Because, and then she tries pulling a pistol on her when they're already down on the ground in the fungus. It's like, oh, please. So, yeah, it's the beginning of, it's easy to find. It's fairly long for what it is. The manga is hard to find.
I would say stick with the film. It's a different story, but well, it's the same story but different path.
Yeah.
Same themes but different overall plot.
Yeah, and it's, again, Miyazaki's a great short story mangaka, but he and Shiro both can get very confusing and very, and their art can get very dirty very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
As in the whole, you know, dust dots and Moebius dots and 20 other things. So, yeah. And so, eventually, but he did make enough money from this that a couple years later, he's got his own studio, and then will start on turning out what we start to recognize as Ghibli films.
Well, I think that about wraps us up for this week for Nausicaä.
Now.
Yeah. We will be back in 2 weeks with a discussion on what is probably the big name and the origin of a lot of space opera anime, Space Battleship Yamato. But until that time, I've been Rick.
And I've been Drew. And we're off to outer space.
And remember, someone had to draw that.